Elvis was now on the cusp of national fame, and until now, he and Cash shared the same manager, Bob Neal. But Colonel Tom Parker had already made himself Elvis's special advisor, and he was luring him away from Sun Records. Mystery Train, Elvis's current single when he and Cash toured West Texas together, would be the last produced by Sam Phillips. Parker called the tour the Elvis Presley Jamboree. Charlie Louvin of the Louvin Brothers remembers the tour as the beginning of the orchestrated hysteria around Elvis. The Colonel and his entourage would give away tickets to little girls in Woolworths and all the dime stores, he says. They were told that the tickets were free, but the one thing they had to do was to holler, "We want Elvis," every few minutes. This was very disturbing for the rest of us. By the time Elvis came on, it was pandemonium. One of Cash's new friends was Sun recording artist Carl Perkins, whom he had met in February when Carl was cutting his second single, Let the Jukebox Keep on Playing, backed with Gone, Gone, Gone. The two men had a lot in common. They were born in the same year, grew up on cotton farms in Mississippi, faced poverty as children, and were now married with families. Carl was a smart songwriter as well as one of the most distinctive young guitarists in the business. His playing style would eventually have a profound effect on the Beatles. On November 19, 1955, Carl and Cash were booked on a show in Gladewater, Texas, where Elvis topped the bill. In the dressing room before the show started, Cash ran through the riff that he had heard on his Twisted tape in Germany. He told Carl that he wanted to write a song about being true to himself, true to Vivian, and true to God. He thought he might call it, "I'm Still Being True," or "I'm Walking the Line." Carl pounced on the idea. He said it should be called "I Walk the Line." Cash wrote the song in 20 minutes. He later said that it was one of those songs just waiting to be written. Cash returned the favor less than a month later when the same package show stopped in Amory, Mississippi. After seeing Carl on stage, Cash was convinced he should record what he described as a bop song, and he began telling Carl a story about C.V. White, a black serviceman who'd been with the 12th RSM in Landsberg. White, a cool dresser, had a way with the local women. He also had a way with words and often amused Cash with particular phrases. As Jack Matheson remembers the incident that Cash related to Carl that night, "Bill Carnahan and I were with John on the chow line and some guy backed up and stood on CV's toes. What he actually said was, 'Hey man, I don't care what you do with my Fraulein or what you do with whatever, but don't step on my blue suede shoes.' The joke was that CV, like the rest of the guys, was wearing his regulation issue black shoes, but at the time blue suedes were in fashion for leisure wear. Carl took the phrase and fashioned it into Blue Suede Shoes, a song that would not only become a hit for him, but for Elvis. Later, he would claim that he wrote it about a boy he had seen dancing in front of the stage in Jackson, Mississippi, who had told his girlfriend to be careful with her footwork lest she tread on his blue suede shoes. In that version of the story, Carl recalled that he woke in the middle of the night, December 17, 1955, wrote the words out on a paper potato sack, and recorded it 2 days later. However, Cash was telling his own version of the story at least as early as January 1957, when he told the Memphis Press Scimitar that he'd given Perkins the original idea. Both Bill Carnahan and Jack Matheson clearly remember the incident with C.V. White. Marshall Grant backs this version of the story, although he sets it 2 months earlier at a September 6th concert in Bono, Arkansas. John told Carl this story about his friend in the service and told him that he should write a song about blue suede shoes, he says. Carl was in the dressing room while someone else was on stage, and then he came out for his set and played it live. Of all the stories that you'll hear, that's what actually happened. I was standing there when it took place. Amazingly, Cash was still combining his work as a salesman with all of the touring. Signing autographs for adoring fans at night, he would knock on doors trying to sell refrigerators the next morning. He kept his day job mostly because, despite the huge sales of Cry, 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 it would eventually sell over 100,000 copies. His first royalty check wasn't due until the account settled at the end of the year. In late November, he wrote to Ted Freeman. "I don't know when I'll quit the home equipment company. I've got 3 personal appearances this week, in Ripley, Bolivar, and Henderson, towns in Tennessee, and 4 next week, but I don't yet know where. One of the local disc jockeys is managing me and booking me. I suppose I'll hang on at selling a while and pick up a few bucks when I can. I haven't the faintest idea how much my record has sold, and I won't know till they check the records and do all the tabulations at the end of this year. On the hit parade here Saturday night, one of the local disc jockeys played my record as number 16, Coast to Coast. I don't know if he was lying or not. I'm anxious to check this week's Cashbox magazine. It was actually number 14 on the country charts of November 26th. Do you hear my record there in West Virginia? My sister said it's hot in Norfolk. Cash released his second single, Folsom Prison Blues, on December 15th. Written from the perspective of a prisoner, it contrasted the restrictions and crushed hopes of jail with the unlimited freedom and hope of someone riding a train. It contained what must be one of the most cruelly dispassionate lines in popular song. I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die, a line he said he made up after asking himself what the most evil reason for killing someone could be. There were precedents in country music. In Blue Yodel No. 1, sometimes known as T for Texas, Jimmy Rogers had written, "I'm gonna buy me a shotgun, just as long as I am tall. I'm gonna shoot poor Thelma, just to see her jump and fall." But in light of Cash's background and the demons that dogged him, it's not difficult to see a connection between the imagined brutality and the real violence he had seen. His father had forced him to watch puppies drown. His uncle had apparently shown him the body of a lynch victim. His brother Jack's body had lain in their house for 2 days while neighbors came calling. The idea that people got pleasure from watching the dead or the dying was not foreign to him. Although no one knew it at the time, the melody of Folsom Prison Blues and much of its imagery had been lifted from part of a song on a 1953 album by composer Gordon Jenkins. Cash likely heard the album, Seven Dreams, when he was in Germany, perhaps played by one of his more sophisticated urban friends. In the second dream of the album, singer Beverly Marr, Jenkins' wife, sings about how she wants to leave Crescent City. "If I owned that lonesome whistle, if that railroad train was mine, I'll bet I'd find a man a little farther down the line. Far from Crescent City is where I'd like to stay, and I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away." Cash's version differed very little. "Well, if they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train was mine, I'd bet I'd move on over a little farther down the line. Far from Folsom Prison, that's where I want to stay, and I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away." Jenkins either didn't hear Folsom Prison Blues at the time or heard it and decided not to act. But 13 years later, when it was recorded live for the best-selling Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison album, Jenkins filed a lawsuit. The claim was eventually settled out of court. On December 3rd, Cash made his first appearance on the Louisiana Hayride, a live radio show with an audience, which KWKH broadcast every Saturday night from the Municipal Auditorium in Shreveport, Louisiana. Having started in April 1948, it became known as a stepping stone to the Grand Ole Opry. Louisiana Hayride had launched the careers of several country stars whom Cash admired, including Farron Young, Webb Pierce, and Hank Williams. Cash gave his all that day in two separate performances, both of which drew encores. Leaving the stage, sweat pouring off his face, he experienced for the first time the sheer intoxication of performing. He finally tasted that rare combination of the audience energy, the thrill of being in the spotlight, the recognition of his peers, and the congenial backstage atmosphere where he mixed easily with stars, agents, and attractive women. The next morning, traveling back to Memphis, Cash saw people driving to church and felt a twinge of conscience knowing that if he wasn't to be seduced by stardom, he should maintain his church connection. When he first returned from Germany, he'd accompany Vivian to a Catholic Mass at 9 a.m. each Sunday, and later alone attended a Baptist service at 10:30, but work began to interfere. The best-paid concerts took place on Saturday nights, which meant they traveled Sunday mornings. Ted Freeman came to see him on the Louisiana Hayride tour, but because of a mix-up, they didn't meet. In his Christmas letter, Cash apologized for not catching Ted in Shreveport, and included a copy of an advertisement they'd paid $310 to run in Billboard, hoping to generate more national attention. "I was on the Big D Jamboree in Dallas 2 weeks ago. I went over as good as I did the night you were at the Louisiana Hayride. They wanted me permanent on the Big D with 1 week a month on the Ozark Jubilee, but they had already made the deal to put me on the Hayride permanent. I told them, didn't I? But they didn't listen. I said, wait. But they didn't wait. I've got a year contract with the Hayride with nights off for guest spots on the Big D, the Jubilee, and the Opry, I hope. I think I can take the top spot on the Hayride away from E. Presley. I got five encores Saturday night, and he didn't get any. That's counting both times I was on Saturday. Say, I'm fixing to buy me a big Martin guitar, nearly new with a heavy leather case, both for $90. That's a right nice deal, and see if it is. That's darn good for a newcomer like me, right? I hope it's so. Cash must have given up his job at the home equipment company in January 1956 when he received his first full royalty check from Sun. With the $6,000, he out-earned his brother Roy's annual salary as a field service representative for the Chrysler Corporation, making more than his father had ever earned in a year. As he approached his 24th birthday, Johnny Cash was indeed doing darn good for a newcomer.